Welcome to Endeavors. Kick it, boys. Afternoon, Radio Land, and welcome to Endeavors on CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby up atop the mountain at Simon Fraser University. You can also find us on cjsf.ca. We stream and podcast all your favorite shows, including the one by yours truly. Or you can listen to us on TELUS HD channel 7014. I think today's show will make you geek out in a ways. It will make you think in a lot of ways. And it will probably horrify you and mortify you in a lot of ways. But I mean that on an intellectual level and not just because we're going to be talking about disgusting things. Politically disgusting things, maybe. Our first guest is SFU Master's graduate, Ashley Morford. She's an English Lit grad. She just got accepted into three different PhD programs, and she'll be talking about fandom, fan fiction, literary criticism, Indigenous queer theory, and specifically how those relate to Sherlock and Frankenstein, which have been the source of her studies. So I'm very excited. I've been wanting to have her on for a while, so we'll get into her with that. And then also, you'll hear from author Suki Kim. She spent a couple of semesters in 2011 teaching at a university in North Korea. She taught English to students at the Pyongyang University of Science and Technology, which is a computer science institution, and at that time, which was the year Kim Jong-il died, was the only open university in North Korea, and it was funded by evangelical Christians in cooperation with the North Korean government. It's a very very interesting and horrifying story, because whatever we think we know here in the West about North Korea, I can almost assure you it is worse, far worse than what we could have imagined. So we'll be talking about that. And the book is called Without You, There Is No Us. The You refers to the great leader, now Kim Jong-un, but of course before Kim Jong-il, and the founder of North Korea, Kim Il-sung. But right now, you'll be hearing from Ashley Morford. She got her bachelor's in Native American Studies and English, and then got her master's in English Lit with a focus on queer Indigenous theory. She did her master's thesis on Indigenous queer theory issues in Sherlock. Specifically, she focused on the BBC adaptation of Sherlock, but she also looked at other parts of the canon, the original stories by Arthur Conan Doyle, and then there's some other adaptations. There was there's the Elementary, of course, and there's some other ones. There's a National Theatre one that was done a little while ago. And And also she looks at some of the characters like Molly Hooper, played by Louise Brealey, and on the BBC show, and Irene Adler focuses on the female content, and she just talks about, you know, sort of how simultaneously Sherlock breaks down some of our new Western ideals about sexuality, while at the same time simultaneously upholding them and reinforcing them. She has also recently been accepted into three different PhD programs, UFT, King's College, and University of Kent. And in her PhD, she'll be focusing on the works of Mary Shelley, and specifically Frankenstein, and looking at how indigenous queer theory relates to Frankenstein, and specifically the creature. It's a very, very interesting and fascinating way to look at classic literature. Ashley, proud to say she's a friend of mine, and I've been wanting to have her on for a while. And here is our extended, uninterrupted chat with Ashley Morford. Well, it's been a while since I've had a physical being in the studio with me, but I have one right now, Ashley Morford. Hello.
Hi.
I've been bugging this lady to come on my show for a few months now, I think. She's an SFU grad. She just completed her master's in English literature, and she just got accepted into three different PhD programs, so she has some decisions to make.
Oh, gosh.
Let me guess it. So there was King's College, mm-hmm. Yes, Toronto,
yep.
And London?
University of Kent.
Kent.
In Canterbury.
Right. So, which all three are great places.
Yes, it's going to be a really difficult decision.
but I kind of wanted to have Ashley on today because she does a lot of work in English literature, obviously, but specifically fandom. And sort of the culture surrounding that, and that's a topic that I've wanted to discuss for a while here on the show. And I thought, what better person to have than a person who does that? And I know for your master's, you focused on Sherlock.
Yes.
What was it about that story or that canon of stories in particular that so attracted you that made you want to study it further?
Mm-hmm. Well, I first saw Sherlock, the BBC's Sherlock, of course, in, I guess it was June 2013. And I remember the first thing that kind of stuck with me was in the first episode, there's the scene in Angelo's between Sherlock and John. And John kind of starts to ask quite overtly about Sherlock's sexuality, you know, asking if he has a girlfriend and whatnot. And that conversation, even though it left sexuality ambiguous, it left both John's and Sherlock's sexualities ambiguous, it really intrigued me. In fact, it was the ambiguity of sexuality as it was presented in that scene that really interested me. And then through my bachelor's degree, so I have a bachelor's degree in English and First Nations Studies, and during my bachelor's degree, I became really interested in Indigenous queer theory. And so I thought, wouldn't it be cool, you know, to take two things that I'm really interested in, that would be Sherlock and then Indigenous queer theory, and kind of bring them together and see what Indigenous queer theory can do in terms of being a framework to look at Sherlock.
You mentioned the BBC series, of course, and I know for me that was sort of my introduction into that world. I mean, obviously I knew the stories, but that was my introduction. And I'm guessing for a lot of people that was their introduction.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think it was about that series in particular that sort of brought forth Sherlock fandom for the 21st century?
There's so many things, but I think the thing that first comes to my mind is Sherlock and John and their relationship. And regardless of how you view their relationship, it is a very special one. And that's not to say that it isn't in the original stories. It's not to say it isn't in adaptations either. But actually, when I was at Sherlock Seattle, they did a montage of, at the very end, it was a fan-made video. And I think watching that video was kind of the epitome of me realizing what is really special to me about the BBC's Sherlock, because they had the Granada series with Jeremy Brett, of course. During that montage of the Granada series, there was so much footage of Holmes, and once in a while, Watson was kind of there in the background. Then when we had the montage of the BBC's Sherlock, it was John and Sherlock the entire time. And so I think I really like the position that John has taken in this series, and I really like how his positioning allows the relationship to unfold. I think I also like the fact that the characters are very obviously paradoxical in their personalities, and I mean not that they're paradoxical to one another, but that each character has a paradoxical personality in themselves. So, you know, you have John, and he is on the surface in many ways. He's kind of the heart, and he seems calm, and then he has these moments where, in the fandom they call it Trash John, he totally freaks out. He yells at Mrs. Hudson before he even really knows her. He sprains someone's, like, wrist because he's craving adventure and danger, and he hasn't had that. So he's a paradox. Then, of course, Sherlock is a paradox. On the surface, he looks like a machine in many ways, but I think within the fandom, you know, we've realized that he's a little teddy bear underneath it all, so he's paradoxical. And even someone like Molly Hooper, who Louise Brealey described her in the Sherlock Chronicles as a mouse, but she's so much more than that. Maybe on the surface, in some ways, she does seem, you know, shy and soft-spoken, but she calls Sherlock out on, you know, what he says, and she... her job, too. If she's a pathologist, she's had a ton of education. She's very smart, and it takes a particular kind of person to be able to do the job she does. I certainly couldn't do it. It would make me very queasy. So she is also a paradox, and I think that has interested me as well. So, yeah, in a nutshell, it would be the relationship between Sherlock and John, and then also the fact that characters are, there's such a mystery that it's so fun to unwrap and to see the way that they, like, are paradoxes, too.
And it's just really well written, I think,
yes.
And really well acted. And
yes, absolutely.
On the acting note, and we're talking about fandom,
mm-hmm.
the fandom surrounding Benedict Cumberbatch
mm-hmm.
seems to... I mean, we've experienced this before, but it seems to be on a whole new level, and maybe that's just, you know, because of the prominence of social media, Facebook and Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, he has one of the most interesting-sounding names for an actor.
Yeah.
But what what do you attribute that to? Obviously, it starts with Sherlock, but it extends beyond that. How do you equate for such that devoted fan following for Benedict, but also for other actors who mm-hmm. who may be strongly identified with a certain role?
Right. I will be honest, for the past couple months, I have been a lot less engaged in the Cumber Collective, as it's often called, and have focused a lot more on just his work, rather than kind of looking at his interviews or his appearances as a guest, and therefore I've been a little bit detached from that side of the fandom. But that being said, just from the experience that I have had in it in the past, I think he's super talented, and so that's one aspect. His name is interesting, as you said. That's another aspect. His voice is beautiful. I mean, you could listen to him, you know, as someone said, listen to him read the dictionary because it's so intriguing. But I think the other thing is that oftentimes when he speaks very eloquently, very intellectually, and he does so much research into the characters that he's playing and really tries to engage with them in an eloquent and intellectual way. And I think that that has drawn a lot of fans in too. I mean, one thing that we can say about both the Sherlock fandom and the Cumber Collective too is that they're both very diverse in a variety of ways. You have people from different walks of life, different ages, doing different kinds of jobs, coming from different parts of the country. And I think part of the reason why he's able to attract a diversity is because of the fact that he's this very full, complete package. He's intellectual. He's an eloquent speaker. He's very talented. He's very charming in his personality. He's dorky in some ways, too, in interviews, and that is charming in itself. And then, he's, you know, for many people, he's very beautiful to look at as well. So he has this kind of full package that is able to reach out to a diverse amount of people.
You mentioned fandom, and sort of with Sherlock and with other aspects, there's a lot of fan fiction, there's a lot of shipping, John Locke is big. And a lot of writers have interesting ideas about fan fiction. I know George R.R. Martin from Game of Thrones says it's a bad exercise for budding writers. But then you've got people like E.L. James, who has made her career being a fan fiction writer with 50 Shades of Grey. Mm-hmm. What is your take on fan fiction and that whole world as an English lit major?
I actually have a huge write-up on this because it's an important one to me. So I read fan fiction. I've read fan fiction since Pirates of the Caribbean, actually, I think is the first time that I started reading fan fiction. My very first ship was Sparrow Beth, which is Elizabeth and Jack Sparrow. But I didn't start writing fan fiction until the Sherlock fandom. So, yes, I know that that certain people have particular views about fan fiction not being a helpful avenue for people who are aspiring writers, but I would disagree, and I found it to be the exact opposite for me. I think, for me, the reason why I found it really helped my writing is that I was really struggling before to kind of create characters in a world. And I was never able to finish any of the novels that I kind of started because of the fact that I couldn't develop characters and couldn't develop a world. With Sherlock, I had a world and characters as kind of a blueprint that I could begin to start with. And yet, the world itself is very mysterious. And as I already said earlier, the characters are very mysterious. And there's so much of them that we can develop as writers. And so I think it was a great way then for me to kind of learn how to develop a character and how to develop a world. And the first time that I actually completed a novel, it was a fan fiction, and that was a huge achievement for me. So, and from there, I'm actually now writing my own original kind of creative writing, and I honestly think that it's because of fan fiction that I was able to do that. So I think that at least for me, has been a draw, and perhaps for other fan fiction writers, that's part of the appeal, is that it can really, I think, honestly help some of us with our writing and the areas of writing that we need to develop or work on or strengthen. I think that there's many other reasons, though, why fan fiction, especially in the world of Sherlock, is important. So my master's paper used Indigenous queer theory to look at the ways that Sherlock, the BBC's Sherlock, can actually challenge and debunk colonial Western perceptions of sexuality. But of course, even in the ways that I see the show challenging these perceptions, I also see it being limited in its ability to challenge. And actually, I think one could argue it in many ways maybe actually reinforces colonial perceptions of sexuality. And what I see fan fiction writers doing, and fan artists as well, what I see them doing is taking the aspects of the show that maybe can challenge and can draw attention to colonial perceptions of sexuality, and they actually like allow those challenges to be made openly and overtly through fan fiction. And so in that way, I think fan fiction is also super important sociopolitically to critique the sociopolitical issues that we really do need to critique.
Well, that's an interesting point. You brought up a lot about sexuality, and I know Stephen Moffat, mm-hmm. who is the creator of Sherlock, has been accused at times of being not necessarily misogynistic, but I guess very male-centric, in which rights, both with Sherlock and especially with Doctor Who. Both Clara and Amy are sort of, you know, the young sort of sexy female type of character. In sort of your studies of Sherlock, have you come across any instances of that? Would you agree with that assessment at all?
I can't speak to Doctor Who because I've avoided Doctor Who for fear of becoming obsessed with it the way that I am with Sherlock. I really can't afford to become obsessed with more things. But in terms of Sherlock, I do wish that the female characters that we have had that they served or were allowed to be their own full characters rather than simply serving as kind of tools for Sherlock. So I love Molly. I will openly say I love Molly. I love what Louise brings to the role of Molly. And yet at this point in the series, she really has only served as a tool for Sherlock, and I really want her to be more than that, and I think Louise does as much as she can to allow her to be more than that, but I would love to see it written so that she is more than that. A character that I've done a lot of studying in and reflection in is Irene Adler, because my master's paper really focused on the character of Irene Adler, both in Scandal in Bohemia, the original, and then Scandal in Belgravia. And in terms of Scandal in Belgravia, I love the fact that Irene she uses sexuality as power. In many ways, she can be seen as a sign of woman's sexuality as power, and basically someone who empowers women to celebrate their sexualities in whatever way they're comfortable. I also think that Irene challenges a lot of colonial perceptions of sexuality. She challenges heteronormativity in many ways. She challenges the idea of sexuality as something that is taboo, or sexual actions as something that should be taboo. So I applaud her character in so many ways, yet cannot also get away from the fact that she is objectified in the show. So there are moments where her sexuality is empowering, but there are also moments where she is, as some would argue, an object for the male gaze and the male audience's gaze. I've heard that argument, and I can understand where it's coming from. So that is certainly problematic, despite the ways that she is an empowering character for me. I also acknowledge that she can be problematic. And then, of course, we can't get away from the fact that in A Scandal in Bohemia, she outwits Holmes, and through outwitting him, she causes him to reconsider his perceptions about females. That's huge. That's huge, and it was during the Victorian era, and yet I do think that with her, Doyle was trying to challenge people's notions of womanhood. And yet, of course, in Scandal in Belgravia, she loses. She is outwitted by Sherlock. Sherlock beats her at the game, and I am always troubled by that. I still do think that Irene Adler is able to unsettle Sherlock Holmes in many ways. She's unsettled him as a person, and in that way she's an empowering woman too, and yet she still is outwitted by him. So I love her, and yet at the same time Moffat, what are you doing?
It may be just be the fact that maybe a lot of male writers don't know how to write for females we don't go through the same experiences.
Perhaps, but at the same time, why is it that, I mean, write a human, right? If you can write a male as a fully developed human, why can't you write a female as a fully developed human? Why don't we see Molly as developed human with her own agency kind of thing, right? I guess that's what I would throw out there then.
So you've talked a lot about indigenous queer theory, mm-hmm. and how you throw that into Sherlock. So how did you decide that that was the focus you were going to take, and how you found that Sherlock was a good avenue for it, especially since there's no indigenous characters in that show,
yes.
in that canon.
Yeah, absolutely. It honestly came to me when I was sitting in my car waiting for a job interview, and I was thinking about research and research interests, and I knew that I wanted to study indigenous queer theory, and I wanted to study sexuality, but I was so in love with and captured by the world of Sherlock and captured by crime fiction. Crime fiction was really something that was very new to me. And I was just sitting there and I thought, well, you know, I'm interested in crime fiction and representations of sexuality in Sherlock, and I'm interested in indigenous queer theory, and I've read, you know, so much about Sherlock and sexuality, because the fandom really does engage with that in many ways, many absolutely magnificent ways. And so I felt like, oh, you know, so many people are already doing that work with Sherlock that I don't really have anything to contribute. But as I'm sitting in my car and I'm thinking, you know, I really want to use Indigenous queer theory in my research. It's a very important framework for me to look at things through. I was thinking, you know, I love Sherlock. It's a lot of people have written on representations of sexuality in Sherlock. And I keep thinking I don't have anything original to contribute. But why don't I, you know, combine my two passions? And honestly, you know, Indigenous studies is something that is still developing and emerging in North America, but I think Indigenous perspectives, they have so much to offer. And of course, you know, Western society privileges a particular type of perspective. And so I also thought this is an opportunity to privilege a perspective that hasn't been allowed to be privileged before and really needs to be considered a dominant type of perception as well, one that should be listened to as well. And so I thought, okay, you know, I can do that here. So yeah, that's kind of how it came together.
Quick note, I want to ask your opinion. You know, there's been a lot of talk lately about the depiction of First Nations in both literature and in Hollywood movies specifically. What do you make of that conversation and sort of where that is headed? Are we seeing more? Are we seeing less? Is it a good representation? Is it a bad?
Yeah. I love looking at representations in Hollywood, and I think that there's so many really problematic representations, especially of Indigenous people in Hollywood in many ways. I mean, we continue to see these problematic stereotypes, you know, of the savage Indian that I constantly want to see debunked. I mean, we had the Lone Ranger, you know, come out recently, and don't get me started on Johnny Depp's costuming and also the choice of Johnny Depp, too. I know that Johnny Depp has said that he is Cherokee. Maybe he is, but perhaps he's not. And I feel that there's a lot of other Indigenous actors who are very talented who should have the opportunity, you know, to be in those kinds of roles. But that being said, there are some awesome movies that have come out of the Indigenous community. So we had one that I recently saw. What is it called? Now I can't remember what it's called. It's something like Rhymes with Young Ghouls. Have you heard of it? Something like that?
Rhymes with Young Ghouls?
It's very good. It's about, it looks a little bit at the residential school legacy. So that one was a great one. Also, Real Injun is a documentary that just came out it came out a couple of years ago, and it's still pretty recent. I really, really love that documentary because I think it's kind of tapping into what you're talking about here. It looks at the Hollywood representation of Indigenous peoples throughout the years coming into the current era. And it does talk about the problematic representations, but then it shows also some positive representations that are coming out of the Indigenous community too. So that's a show that I recommend for everyone to see because I think it does a very good job of highlighting an important issue that people need to be aware of and pointing to good representations that people need to engage with and see in favor of the problematic ones in Hollywood that are you know, so often shown.
And I know part of your job, I guess, as an English lit major is literary criticism. When you do something like that, you know, with Sherlock or Frankenstein, which we'll get to in a minute, what do you look for when critiquing?
I am always looking for the ways that a text can potentially decolonize colonial perceptions. And then also the ways that it reinforces colonial perceptions. So my main interest is looking at decolonization and decolonizing methodologies and the potentials to decolonize. And of course, by that, I mean challenging and debunking Western colonial perceptions. That would be what I mean by decolonization. So I always want to see how a text does that, if it does. And if it doesn't, how does it reinforce colonial views or colonizing views? And that's always like my main interest when I approach something to read or even to watch.
And finally, we mentioned your PhD at the top of the show, and I know you're going to be focusing on Frankenstein.
Yes.
Again, sort of similar era, maybe a little bit before.
A little bit before
Sherlock.
Yeah.
What fascinates you about Mary Shelley? I mean, I think I read she was sort of one of the first female horror authors that really made a name for herself. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, was there anything particular about that story and how it ties into your study of queer Indigenous theory that said this is the next one I'm gonna tackle?
Right. Going back to decolonizing methodologies, I'm interested in representations of the other. When we talk about the other, we're talking about what Western society has deemed non-normal, and oftentimes then represents as inferior, as immoral, as savage, as all these problematic ideas that I really want to challenge and decolonize. So I became interested in the creature and how the creature is represented, but also challenges the idea of the other. And the creature, I really think, brings up an interesting question about societal creations and societal imaginations versus innate natures. And I think that in Frankenstein, there's really the suggestion that this idea of the other is a societal creation that is only in the imagination. So I think that's awesome. The other thing is that there's so many adaptations of Frankenstein. And Nick Deers in 2011, which Benedict Cumberbatch is in, of course, too. The first thing that I thought when I saw it is how problematically it deals with representations of the female. And even the Boris Karloff movie, which is very far from Mary Shelley's original, it's also problematic in terms of how it represents many things, including the woman. And I thought, why is the original, which is so much older, you know, why does it do a much better job of dealing with gender representations? And then, of course, I realized, oh, when we talk about the Boris Karloff movie or the 2011 National Theater version, these are ones that are created by a male, and Mary Shelley is a female, and perhaps that's why I'm just fascinated by the fact that hers is in many ways the most open-minded and the most wonderful in terms of representations of gender, even though it's much older. But of course, she is a woman herself, so that really fascinated me too. Yeah.
And we should point out there are two new Frankenstein adaptations in the works. One, I believe, is being directed by Guillermo del Toro.
That's right,
who I think will do a great job. That seems to be right up his alley. Well, I have to end it there, but Ashley Morford, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that was SFU grad and current, soon-to-be PhD candidate of English literature, Ashley Morford. Stay tuned. We're going to have big things from Ashley in the future, I'm sure. My next guest is an award-winning author whose debut work of fiction, The Interpreter, won the Pen Beyond Margins Award and the Gustavus Myers Outstanding Book Award, and was a finalist for the Hemingway Foundation Pen Award, and it was translated into Dutch, French, Korean, Italian, and Japanese. She is a graduate from Barnard College with a BA in English and a minor in East Asian Literature, has studied at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London, and has received a Fulbright grant, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and an Open Society Foundations Fellowship. She first visited North Korea in 2002 to participate in the 60th birthday celebration of Kim Jong-il, and she wrote a cover essay for the New York Review of Books. And in 2008, as a journalist, she accompanied the New York Philharmonic when they traveled to Pyongyang and wrote her article, A Really Big Show, The New York Philharmonic's Fantasia in North Korea, which was published in Harper's in 2008. Her latest book is the nonfiction Without You, There Is No Us, about her 6 months teaching English to the sons of the North Korean elite at the Pyongyang University of Science and Technology. She is Suki Kim, and she joined me earlier today from New York City. Suki Kim, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for inviting me to the show.
So your book is Without You, There Is No Us. And it's about your time teaching in North Korea. Why did you decide to do this?
Well, I've gone to, North Korea. I visited North Korea since 2002. And it's kind of impossible to see North Korea and for real and write about it with any meaning, because basically they only show you what they want to show you. It's all government propaganda. So I was looking for a way to be embedded, and then I found out about the school that was being built. And I applied, and then I went in essentially to write a book to, I guess, undercover.
You know, and the school you taught at, the Pyongyang University of Science and Technology, was, if I'm correct, started by missionaries, and those missionaries are undercover as teachers, and you're a writer undercover as a missionary, undercover as a teacher.
Well, actually, those missionaries, they're evangelical Christians, and they made a deal with the North Korean government. So what it is that they have made an agreement with the regime, cooperating with the North Korean regime, to go in there and fund and build this school completely. You know, North Korea doesn't pay a penny. And these evangelicals, what they have made a pact is to not proselytize. So the fact that they are actually evangelical Christians is just not out in open. They keep quiet about that. But the government knows exactly who they are.
But how was it for you in terms of sort of the deception that you were giving? Were you ever worried about being caught?
I mean, I wouldn't call that deception. I mean, I think that there is no way of covering North Korea without actually being embedded, because this is one particular regime, the most corrupt one in the world, which is just not going to let you investigate them. So, you know, investigation itself is something that they will never allow you to do. So, of course, I was scared, because I was secretly writing notes. And you know, I came out of there with 400-page notes.
For me, you know, I read the book, but I found at times it was hard for me to read, just because of some of the things that the students were saying. And I think out here in the West, you know, in North America, we have a very specific idea of what North Korea is. How similar would you say our ideas to what actually happens and goes on in North Korea?
Well, the West knows very little about North Korea. I think for some odd reason, North Korea became a butt of jokes in the West. You know, there's just this endless, very tiresome Kim Jong-un jokes, which I find very odd. It's the most brutal regime in the world. UN calls them the most horrific violator of human rights in the contemporary world, unsurpassed. Basically, we have this either Kim Jong-un jokes or nuclear threat information and some famine. But other than that, I think that the West has no clue, really, what is going on there. And, you know, for years, a decade, I've interviewed a lot of defectors who flee North Korea. I knew about the just gruesome human rights violation that happened to the, you know, the regular people there, because it's a country of gulags, essentially. But I did not expect the elite to be under such similar, I guess, deprivation of freedom, which is what I saw this time.
Well, what I found interesting is that all these students, well, first of all, that it was largely segregated, if I'm correct, at least the schooling system was, but that the fact that they are computer science majors and they have no concept of what the internet is. Why do you think the regime fears the internet?
Well, internet is information. North Korea is a country where information is completely blocked. You know, you can't travel outside. No North Koreans can leave the country, virtually no one, unless they flee, risking execution or gulag sentences. Or within the country, they can't travel. Even within North Korea, from a town to town, you need a travel pass. There's virtually no poster system that's functioning. You know, any phone conversation would be tapped. So, you know, it is a place where it's also entire thing is about the great leader. There's only one television channel featuring the great leader, one newspaper, every article is the great leader. So every information has been censored from people. Internet would be the surest way to dismantle that regime.
You mentioned, you know, how in out here in the West, it's often become the butt of jokes. And I'm curious what you thought of the controversy surrounding the movie The Interview and how the United States accused North Korea of hacking Sony. Do you think that was something North Korea would do? Do you buy that story?
You know, the whole chaos surrounding Interview was an odd one because, first of all, the movie is not really worthy of an international scandal. I mean, it was actually about two white guys who go rescue, you know, sort of like a Dumb and Dumber or a Bill and Ted kind of film with North Korea as an accidental backdrop. Also, it was about going to rescue North Korea, really, and that's what that movie is, and killing, the scene of actually killing the sitting president of the country, blowing him up. You know, it's. I've just never seen anything like that. It's so dehumanizing. I don't care if it's, you know, evil or not evil. On top of it, this, you know, utter hypocrisy of this story, which actually in reality, you know, North Korea was actually created by the United States when two guys, Charles Bonesteel and Dean Rusk, drew up the 38th parallel. You know, that was at the end of a world reorder done by the Allies. So The Interview, without any reference to any of that history, you know, it was as crass as it could be. And what was amazing was that, you know, with hardly any proof, the U.S. toughened the sanction against North Korea right after that, which I also thought was amazing that you could actually use this suspicion about hacking without any real proof that you gave it to people and then actually toughened the sanctions against the whole nation. So overall, I think that was one of the seediest scandals of the recent era.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up the point about North Korea being effectively created by the U.S., because what I find odd is that North Korea definitely has a strong hatred for America, and yet their favorite sport seems to be basketball, which is a Western invention. Did you find sort of any struggle in the dichotomy of the regime hating the Americans, but the students wanting to learn more about the West at all?
I mean, I think that in any abused situation, you know, North Korea basically is a gigantic abusive, you know, home. I mean, I think that if you were to think of it as a household. So I think that the ones who are abused are, you know, whether it's elite or the bottom class, are actually the regular people. So, yes, I mean, there's this thirst for wanting to connect with the outside, but that is just so stifled there that it's impossible to really note that in a way. You know, I began to get a glimpse of it here and there, but it's a system where within that school, that very, very privileged school, you know, none of them had a moment to be free because they were all watched 24/7. You know, the students watch each other, and there's actually minders on campus watching the teacher, counterparts, which are the North Korean staff who watch your lesson plans. And also they have a thing called daily unity critique where they actually have to report on each other. So it's really not a system where you can even remotely express yourself without fearing some, you know, persecution, which in that country is an unthinkable level of punishment. So yes, there is I think a hint of wanting, if you're that abused and that suppressed, of course you would want to know what is more outside. You know, they were very bright students, you know, they must have guessed something else was going on, but you know, they are in this system where from birth they'd never been allowed to do anything on their own, go anywhere on their own.
And you know, I'm curious for you because you're, you know, North Korea is officially an atheist state, and you're a non-religious person working for a religious organization in a non-religious state. How many what sort of conflict was there like for you being in that unique situation?
You know, I don't know if North Korea is an atheist society because non-religious, because it's basically a cult, a religious cult surrounding the great leader. I mean, you know, you have a country where you have these three generations of men whose faces are on every single blank space of the country. Every chest of every person, they're wearing a badge of the great leader. You know, every song, every slogan, even the mountains are covered with great leader praising, you know, signs literally inscribed onto the mountain themselves. It's a place where there is no other thing. You know, that's why the title of the book, Without You, There Is No Us, is really a song my students used to sing, because nothing else was allowed to be in that country. Not even you, you know, not even us, no person. So, I mean, being in that such a fundamental belief system of as one society, and I actually went in with a group that was incredibly fundamental Christian. So it's not about the religion itself. It's that level of fundamental faith in something so absolute. It was a very jarring place to be, because I didn't, you know, I'm not a believer of anything to that degree, except perhaps human rights.
Do you think, you know, having spent a lot of time in North Korea, is there a way to break that cycle? Do you think there can be a Korean spring, so to speak?
You know, I think that that year when I was there, they shut down every university in the country and put every university students in the construction field, except the 270 students at Pyongyang University of Science and Technology, because those were obviously the creme de la creme of the country. Everybody else was in construction field doing manual labor to build a powerful and prosperous nation. Part of that reason, although that's, you know, they were giving the reason, they were celebrating the 100th birthday of the original great leader. The real reason, it appeared to be, was because around the world at the same time was Arab Spring. And, you know, I mean, by the end of that year, Kim Jong-il died and Kim Jong-un came to power. So a regime change was coming. You know, this Arab Spring, clearly what they feared, I find it really difficult to fathom, because North Korea is so different. You need the internet in order to share any information. You need to be able to move about physically if you were to gather in any way to start a revolution, per se. You need a way to congregate. And, you know, it's also a system where they destroyed trust among human beings, because everybody has to watch each other and report on each other. So if you have trust missing and means of communication missing, any sort of medium through which you can communicate, any method through which you can travel physically together. Also, another thing that is really scary about all of that is that every information has been wiped out of that country. You know, people don't learn anything except the great leader, you know, from newspaper, from television, from books, from songs, from no history exists except the great leader. So they don't even have the intellectual background with which to, you know, start a revolution. So I find it very bleak, but, you know, I would love to be proven wrong.
And how closely did you get a sense of how closely the regime monitors some of its defectors? I mean, there's been a couple of big names. I think I read Kim Jong-un's older brother lives in China, and that the founder, or one of the sort of the founders of JUS, Hwang Jan-yop, I think, defected to the south. Do you get any indication of how closely those are monitored to make sure that those people don't speak bad about the regime?
No, there have been, you know, many, many defectors. The number is decreasing now under Kim Jong-un regime. Currently, there's 27,000 defectors in South Korea. Hundreds of thousands are lost within the Chinese border, which borders North Korea. I went to all those places, interviewed many, many defectors. You know, defectors are not monitored the same way. You know, they're leading ones, like, you know, Hwang Jang-yeop, who's now dead. But, you know, those are, you know, kind of meaningless to the people who are inside, because people who are inside and the watch they have over those people is, you know, they're just so airtight. There is just no room. I think in the rest of the world, we would love to pretend it's not as bad as we hear. I don't know. There's something really disturbing about human nature. You know, whenever I see all these articles about how people in Pyongyang are downloading soap opera and watching them, and you know, perhaps there's a minor in the population that might be slightly changing, which I hope is true. But, you know, what I saw there through 10 years, the utter absolute owning of humans from its regime. It's just absolute. I mean, I've never seen any control that is that disturbing.
I want to talk about, you know, it borders China, and I want to talk about the influence of the Chinese, and if that massive state, that massive economy, plays a role in all, and not necessarily propping up North Korea, but at least sort of lending support to that area of the world. Does China come in anywhere here?
I mean, China is North Korea's only friend. Although now the relation with Russia is you know back to improving, but Chinese influence is kind of a important and yet just enabling one, because China is, you know, at this point capitalist. So in a way, they're becoming better friends with South Korea. So it's a position in between, where what they really care is for North Korea to not fall apart, because then they would have to deal with 25 million refugees. So China sort of enables North Korea, you know, being its only unofficial or, you know, some official trading partner, and then maintains it the way it is, that it's been, so that, you know, North Korea will not fall. In many ways, any surrounding country, be it Russia or South Korea or Japan or America, from being involved, you know, as much as they talk about bringing freedom to North Korea, what is bringing freedom to North Korea, really? You know, how is it possible to bring market culture and the internet information to the system of great leader? That's actually just not possible, because the minute you Google Kim Jong-un and find out he's not who he is, entire great leader system falls apart. So I think that it's, I mean, politics is a very a disturbing one, because I think the front of wanting to save these 25 million people in North Korea is not being done. I think that politically, foreign policy-wise, all any of these involved countries are doing is enabling that regime so it doesn't fall, so none of them have to pay for the refugee crisis that would ensue. Not only just refugees, but 25 million psychologically traumatized people who have been raised in the system of the great leader. It's a huge problem that nobody wants to undertake.
So do you think reunification will ever be possible, ever occur? And if so, under what circumstances?
I just don't think it's a realistic possibility. Reunification how? South Korea is one of the richest countries in the world. So if there is a reunification, they have to kind of maintain North Korea the way it is, you know, prop up its economy. But the, you know, propping up its economy, reunification where it becomes one country is not possible unless North Korea falls. You know, that's one scenario. But is that going to happen? If that happens, then South Korea basically ends up having to feed North Korea, which is a hugely expensive problem, which South Korea does not want. If they were to actually keep up with two different governments, meaning prop up North Korea's economy and, you know, let it be, you know, what it is, and then they have some sort of, like a relationship between the two. Right now, there is no relationship. But if they were to actually be able to travel to the other country and have some sort of a warm relationship, how is that possible under the great leader? Because the entire system of the great leader is built around a premise where people remain ignorant and absolute obedience is required, and actually censoring of information, because it's not possible to keep up the myth of the great leader once people are educated. So I think that, you know, when people compare North Korea to Germany or fall of Soviet Union or even what happened to China, it is a little bit different, this case, because it is such a cult ideology, and you also have South Korea as the other part of the equation.
Would you draw any comparisons to maybe the Israeli-Palestine conflict?
No, I mean, I think that's such a different history, and, you know, that's based on a different religion. And I don't think that we can really compare to that. I think what the only other regime that I can think of, you know, the absoluteness, I mean, you know, whether it was Nazi Germany or Pol Pot's Cambodia, you know, I think those regimes, it was not possible to soften you know, the way that they controlled people. It was either everything or nothing. And I think that's what is at the root of North Korea. You know, when I think, you know, I went in there. You asked me in the beginning, why did I go there? You know, I am Korean. I grew up in Korea, South Korea, and I come from separated families. It's a very personal issue. It's not a journalistic issue. It's actually a personal issue for me. And I think that, you know, the more and more I went in five times over a decade. And what I feared, you know, what looks actually, you can kind of guess when you first go to North Korea from the absolute control and the fact that you're not allowed to see anything, do anything. You can kind of guess what might be behind that veil. But I feel like, you know, and I was embedded there in order to understand better. And I feel that I've gotten to as close to as I possibly could. And what I saw was beyond my worst nightmare. So that's why, you know, I might sound really hopeless about the whole thing, but I don't really see how you can soften that regime, you know, throw in enough information, make it stand on its own and continue somehow within its own system. It's not that kind of a thing. It's really all or nothing.
Well, it's a fascinating if yet horrifying look into that world and into that country. And once again, the book is Without You, There Is No Us. Suki Kim, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
All righty, have a good day. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Suki Kim, the author of the book Without You, There Is No Us, and I spoke to her in New York City. That's our show for this week. My thanks to Suki Kim, and my thanks to Ashley Morford. This is Dan from Endeavors on CJSF, and we will see you next week. Thanks for tuning in. Bye, everybody. Bye.